Hi, welcome. I'm Sally Davidoff. Before we begin, I'd like to ask you to take a moment to fill out the survey you found on your seat, if you're willing. That's for the More Speech website. We ask you a question and post the replies, which make for an interesting conversation on morespeech.us. So let's take 2 minutes for that. Thank you very much. If you did fill out the survey, and also if you didn't, could you please put it under your chair? That would make it easy for us to find it afterward. And perhaps also the pencil. Thanks. And this is also a good time to turn off your cell phone or silence it. Now we're done with all that. Thank you for being here tonight at the New York Society Library, New York's oldest cultural institution. And thanks to the library for partnering with More Speech once again. It is our great pleasure to present tonight's talk by Jonathan Michael Square, A Stain on an All-American Brand, How Brooks Brothers Once Clothed Slaves. Jonathan Michael Square is a writer and historian specializing in fashion and visual culture of the African diaspora. He holds a PhD in history from New York University and degrees from the University of Texas at Austin and Cornell. He's currently a faculty member in the Committee on Degrees in History and Literature at Harvard. Following the presentation, Dr. Square will talk with Elizabeth Way, Assistant Curator of Costume at the Museum of Fashion of the Fashion Institute of Technology. Ms. Way co-curated the exhibition Global Fashion Capitals in 2015 and the exhibition Black Fashion Designers in 2016, and last year she curated Fabric in Fashion. Her publications include several articles and chapters on the intersection of African-American culture and fashion, most recently the chapter Strands of the Diaspora, Black Hair in the Americas, 1800 to 1920, in A Cultural History of Hair in the Age of Empire, which was published last year. Following their conversation, the speakers will invite your questions. More Speech presents occasional events featuring artists and scholars whose work reflects their experience of America. The name comes from President Obama, who said, "More speech lifts up the values of understanding and mutual respect." The shadow title of More Speech is More Listening. So let's listen. Jonathan.
Hello, everyone. Can everyone hear me? Okay. Perfect. Well, I just want to start off by showing a little gratitude first to Sally for organizing this event. And I also want to thank the New York Society Library for hosting us. I also want to thank Liz Way for being in conversation with me shortly. And also, I just want to thank you all for coming out on this Thursday night. So, thank you. So, tonight, I'm going to talk about Brooks Brothers and its connection to slavery. first, before I talk about Brooks Brothers, I want to talk about just the topic in general, fashion and slavery. So I researched how enslaved peoples use their fashion bodies to fight for more freedom, but also express their multifarious identities. So when you think about fashion, rarely do you think about the transatlantic slave trade or slavery. But actually, what I'm arguing here is that there's an intimate connection between the two things. I have made a career studying the connection between fashion and slavery, two seemingly disparate areas of study. And, you know, when you think fashion, you think autonomy, self-determination. And when you think of slavery, you think of the exact opposite, the antithesis, which is a deprivation of freedom, selfhood, self-determination. But there's actually an intimate relationship between the two. And what you see in the study is that there's a lot of connections between fashion and slavery. I am in particular interested in how the interaction between enslaved peoples and American institutions through the lens of fashion. So how exactly did enslaved peoples acquire clothing? Or stated differently, how do academics study the relationship between the fashion system and the institution of slavery? Most often, enslaved people receive lengths of shoddily made cotton and linen, what's often referred to as Negro cloth, which they were responsible for hand sewing into their own clothing. Enslaved peoples also bought clothing and accessories with small amounts of money that they gained through extra work for their owners or for others, whether it's raising vegetables, poultry, hunting, fishing, or artisanal work. There was also a secondhand clothing market in which enslaved peoples bought, sold, and bartered garments. And of course, enslaved people sometimes received cast-offs from their owners. Occasionally, domestic and or favored slaves received garments that were manufactured in Europe or in the Northeast, as is the case with two Brooks Brothers coats, which will be the focus of this talk. But before I show you those coats, I want to show you another image. I'll let you take in that image for a moment. There's a lot to take in. But it's important to note that Brooks Brothers is a brand that's embedded in American history and is often associated with the American presidency. For example, Abraham Lincoln was wearing a Brooks Brothers coat when he was shot by John Wilkes Booth in Ford's Theater. Also, JFK was wearing a button-down Brooks Brothers shirt when he was assassinated in Dallas. In this image, we see, of course, Donald Trump and former President Barack Obama, and they're wearing nearly identical Brooks Brothers coats, which led one writer to quip, at least Republicans and Democrats can agree on one thing. In fact, 40 out of 45 presidents were outfitted by Brooks Brothers. Can anyone guess the five presidents that aren't on this list? Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Reagan, Jimmy Carter, right, exactly. So George Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, Jimmy Carter, and Ronald Reagan. So Brooks Brothers was founded in 1818, so the first three presidents weren't able to be outfitted by Brooks Brothers. And Jimmy Carter was apparently very thrifty and just wore the same old dusty suits that he owned before he was president. And Ronald Reagan had a personal tailor that he'd had. Oh, wow. Great. Ronald Reagan had a personal tailor that he'd had since he was an actor in Hollywood. So. How many of these presidents do you think were also slave owners? Just out of curiosity. Many. Well, I'm not going to make you guess. Basically, the first column. Madison, Monroe, Jackson, Van Buren, Harrison, Tyler, Polk, Taylor, and Grant. Andrew Jackson was a slave owner, but not when he was before he was president. essentially. So these are the two coats that are the point of departure for this talk. They were made for two enslaved boys in the household of a man named William Newton Mercer, and I'll show you a photograph of him later, well, a portrait of him later. But William Newton Mercer was born in Maryland. He studied medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, and he served as a surgeon in the U.S. Army before setting up a private practice in Natchez, Mississippi. When he moved to Natchez, he married into a planter family, and when both his father-in-law and his wife died, he inherited all their properties, which included four plantations. He subsequently served as the president of the Bank of Louisiana, and he eventually moved to Canal Street in New Orleans. And I just want to show you this image. As you can see, William Newton Mercer owned over 200 slaves. And this is a list and inventory of enslaved peoples. And you can see here it says 267 enslaved peoples. And right here on the same inventory is cattle, mules, hogs, and horses, which he owned 229. So it's interesting to think about the ways in which enslaved peoples were cataloged in inventory alongside cattle and livestock. This is a close-up shot of one of the jackets. So you can see in this image the Brooks Brothers label. It's a bit worn off a little bit, but at the very top you can see Brooks Brothers in the middle of Broadway, Grand Street, New York. So many people don't realize that Brooks Brothers responded to the need of slave masters to adorn their human property. In the wealthiest households, enslaved peoples were dressed in garments that ostentatiously reflected the privilege of their owners. Given the size and style of these coats, they were most likely made for young enslaved boys within his household. And this is a portrait of William Newton Mercer. So I had the opportunity to go into William Newton Mercer's papers, which are archived at Louisiana State University. And this is a receipt that I found in his papers. It's actually a receipt from Charles P. Leverett. Charles P. Leverett was a factor or an accountant. He represented many of the biggest slave owners in the American South. But he was based in New York. And so this is a receipt, or more like a bank statement. I think it's a better way to think about it. It's more of a bank statement from his papers. And you can see, I've used the magnifying feature, and I've sort of highlighted Brooks Brothers. But this actually isn't the only receipt from Brooks Brothers. There's actually several receipts from Brooks Brothers. So he was a loyal customer of Brooks Brothers. So not only did he buy garments for himself, but he bought garments for enslaved peoples in his household. Also in the same archive, he has all his receipts archived. So he was actually quite wealthy, as you guys have probably guessed, and he spent a lot of money at Brooks Brothers, but also many other clothers. So I saw receipts for hotel bills, gourmet dinners. He traveled a lot, so there was receipts from Savile Row, receipts from New York City, from Newport, Rhode Island. So he traveled a lot, and he also spent a lot of money. Okay, so this is a letter correspondence between William Newton Mercer and his overseer. An overseer is kind of not the right word to use. I think a better way to say it would be a director of operations, because he ran all four plantations. His name was Wilbur Shields, And actually, Wilbur Shields was quite well-educated. He had a law degree. And he also had really good handwriting, which, you know, for a historian, I really appreciate. And they wrote each other back and forth for years. And in the letters, he talks about the running of the plantations. He talks about enslaved peoples by name. And I found this letter to be really interesting because, one, he refers to several enslaved peoples by their names, but he also says, and I'm just going to read, I propose to give the medals to Caesar, Ellen, Frank, and perhaps Bessie. They have been perfectly faithful to you, far more than Solomon when he was here. The medals coming from me would be little value, but from you greatly. And actually, it's interesting to think about the date on a letter. It's dated September 20th, 1865. So this was actually after the Civil War, sort of in the beginning of the Reconstruction era. So they were actually free persons, but they were treated as if they were enslaved. And what he's saying here is this letter is from Wilbur Shields to William Newton Mercer. And he's saying that they should be rewarded for their good behavior with medals. And the reason I think this letter is interesting is because it just shows how fashion and accessories and beauty were sort of tied up in a system of awards and punishments that help plantations and slave societies run smoothly. So let's talk about that a little bit, fashion as an incentive. Overseers, domestic slaves, and favored and or productive slaves sometimes received fine clothing that was manufactured in the Northeast or Europe. Enslaved peoples were encouraged by a system that included both hand-me-downs and new garments. Fashion was thus embedded in a system of rewards and punishment that helped plantations and slave societies run smoothly. And I have an example of that. This is a newspaper article that was published in 1898, and it's a feature about a man named Peter Fawcett. And Peter Fawcett grew up in Thomas Jefferson's household at Monticello, and he was a young enslaved boy in his household. So you can imagine by 1898, he was quite elderly, but he was reflecting on his time at Monticello. And the Fawcett family was similar to the Hemings family in that they were relatively privileged vis-a-vis most enslaved peoples. They weren't field slaves. They worked in the household, Thomas Jefferson's household. Unlike the Hemings, the Fawcett family actually did not, they weren't related to the Jeffersons the way the Hemings were. So in the article, there's one interesting quote where he says, "As a boy, I was not only brought up differently, but dressed unlike the plantation boys." So you see the ways in which dress sort of reinforced hierarchies amongst enslaved peoples. Of course, domestic slaves, favored and or productive slaves, were often rewarded with better clothing, like the Brooks Brothers coats today showed you earlier. So William Newton Mercer owned 4 plantations in Mississippi. But he also had a household in New Orleans on Canal Street, if anyone's been to New Orleans. It's a street that's lined with mansions. And the young boys who wore these Brooks Brothers coats actually worked in that household on Canal Street in New Orleans. So in this way, the quotes were a reflection of William Newton Mercer's plantocratic wealth. They were styled to represent the power and importance of a wealthy plantation owner. One thing that I find interesting about these coats is that they're lined with silver buttons. And if you can't see it in this photo, but if you look really closely at the buttons, they're actually falcons on each button. And the Mercer family crest also has a falcon on it. So this actually isn't one of the buttons. This is a silver tray that's, like the coats, also in Historic New Orleans collection. And as you can see, the silver tray has a falcon on it and an M representing the last name Mercer. So enslaved peoples, like fashion and luxury goods, were commodities. And Mercer treated his slaves as possessions the same way as finery in his home. For that reason, he provided his enslaved valets with Brooks Brothers coats with buttons emblazoned with his family crest. So this is not a Brooks Brothers coat. This is another coat that was worn by an enslaved man. It's in the Maryland Historical Society's collection. This enslaved man worked in the Ridgely household, and that estate is still around. It's now called the Hampton National Historic Site. And unlike the two coats, we know the name of the man who actually wore this coat because it's actually sewn in the label of the coat. Unfortunately for the Brooks Brothers coats that are the inspiration for this talk, we don't know the names of the young boys who wore those coats. But the man who wore this coat was a man named Tillman Davis, or he was known as Tom Davis. But there are a number of, again, interesting elements in this coat. And actually, he wore a beaver hat alongside with this coat, so you can imagine he had a very impressive profile when he wore these clothes. But if you look at the button, you see a stag on it. And just the way that Mercer put falcons on the buttons of his coat to sort of reflect his dynastic prosperity, the Ridgely family also put stags on the buttons of their coat to represent the family wealth and prosperity. And in the top left corner, you see a stag. And I don't know what these things are called, but you know, in like a fancy home, there's like a thing right here, and you sort of put the curtain behind it. I don't know the name. But again, you see the stag again. That's in Maryland, yeah, rural Maryland. So now I want to go back to Brooks Brothers. I think these coats show that there was a symbiotic relationship between manufacturers and retailers in centers of commerce in the North and producers of raw materials and consumers in the South. And I think another bit of evidence is the fact that Brooks Brothers was located in Lower Manhattan on the corner of Catherine and, I think, Cherry Street. And that location was just walking distance from several ports, including slave ports. So Brooks Brothers serviced not only New York City residents and people in the Northeast, but also people globally and people from the American South. And I think this is reflected in this newspaper article, which is titled The Tailor's Appeal from 1853. And in this article, Brooks Brothers is among a group of businesses and who are complaining about unpaid bills from what they call Southern work employers, which is a euphemism for slave owners, enslavers. They complain that Southern merchants or Southern slave owners employed their services, but they weren't recompensed fairly or at all. And as you can see on this, well, you probably can't see it, but number 29, says Brooks Brothers. And I've done a little research on some of the other firms that are on this list. Most of them do not exist anymore, but there are two that still exists. And as far as I know, they haven't admitted their connection to slavery. The first is Hewitt Lees and Company, which is an investment and banking brokerage firm. It's called Laidlaw & Company today. And the second company on the list that's that still exists is Brown Brothers, which is a bank that you might have heard of. So to wrap up, I think it's important to note that Brooks Brothers is fully embedded in American history, which includes the most American of institutions, slavery. The success and longevity of Brooks Brothers is due in part to its connection to slavery and the profits it gained from selling clothes to planters in the South. By counting slave owners among its clientele, Brooks Brothers directly benefited from the buying and selling of enslaved men, women, and children. And if you found this talk interesting, feel free to follow me on the platform of your choice. I'm very active on social media, and I share my research and insights almost on a daily basis. And I, for the second part of our talk, I'll be in conversation with Liz Way. So we're going to transition.
Can everyone hear
Hello.
Me?
Hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Thank you, Jonathan. That was such an interesting talk. I have heard about your research before, but this is actually the first time I've actually had a full presentation on it. So it was very lovely to hear all about that. So I just have a few questions for you, and we'll talk a little bit, and then we'll open it up to questions from the audience. You know, I've done a little bit of research on the connection between African American history and fashion, not so much about slavery and fashion, a little bit after that period. But one of the things that myself and other researchers, for example, my co-curator and our Black Fashion Designers exhibition, we are really interested in thinking about black makers and how black people can really use fashion and kind of harness it to wield their own creativity and also, you know, economic gains, a lot of kind of the benefits that come out of fashion. But this, your research really focuses on kind of the opposite on how fashion, how clothing is imposed on enslaved people. So it's really kind of two sides of the similar story. So my question is really, how can we use these objects and your research, all the archive research that you've done, to kind of think about the lived experiences of these two boys through their jackets?
Absolutely, that's a really good question. And actually, Sally, you had a very similar question when we were preparing for this talk, because even though I said that my research is on, you know, enslaved people's agency and how they express their identities and far from our freedom using fashion, this talk is kind of the opposite of that. And that's, you know, it's something I'm going to try to do as I continue this research, because I think it's a really important question. What was the lived experience of being an enslaved valet in the household of William Newton Mercer? And I think one answer to your question is actually just looking at the coats, doing a close reading of the coats, looking at the wear of the coats, thinking about conditions within the household. How was it being an enslaved child in mid-century New Orleans? But I think it's one of the central conundrums of studying slavery. You want to get at the experience of enslaved peoples, but there's very little documentation around it, beyond the list of enslaved peoples that I showed you. It's a hard question, and I'm going to continue to try to incorporate into my research. But yeah, I mean, this is one chapter in what's hopefully a book manuscript, and the other chapters actually focus on enslaved people's agency. So.
Can you tell from the coats about how old these boys would have been?
8, 9, 10, uh-huh. Yeah.
I'm really interested in kind of Brooks Brothers' reaction to your research. You know, how do they feel with you in their archives? You're obviously a well-known scholar of slavery and fashion, so they must have had some clue about what you might write about when you access their archives.
Woo! Actually, I have been doing this project without having access to Brooks Brothers' archive. I've had to sort of triangulate around Brooks Brothers Archive, because I've tried contacting them and they haven't been responsive, which makes all the sense in the world. You don't want some scholar slavery snooping on your archive. But yeah, I think I think that's one response, but also another response would be like, we've been around for 200 years. This is part of our history. We're an American brand. We're going to work through this collective trauma together. So we're going to invite scholars into the archive to sort of, basically, we want to control the narrative as opposed to me sort of controlling the narrative. But they've been completely unresponsive. So funny enough, yeah, I haven't had access to the archive. I would love to have access to the archive. If someone here is from Brooks Brothers, please come talk to me afterwards, because I think it would really enrich my project. But since I've been using other sources.
What other archives have you accessed for your research?
The New York Historic Collection. Oh, sorry, not the New York. The New Orleans Historic Collection. So those quotes are part of the New York, New Orleans Historic Collection's permanent collection. And also the silver tray that I showed you is part of the New Orleans Historic Collection. Newspapers online. So the Taylor's Appeal is from the New York Tribune. So that was online. What else have I used for sources? The image that I showed you of Brooks Brothers is from a published account. But I haven't had access to their archive, which is, this is a long aside, but their archive is actually really interesting. I think the story of their archive could be an article in and of itself, because at some point, Brooks Brothers, they weren't doing well financially, and there was no one running their archive. And this guy named Bruce, I forget his last name, started a company in the 1970s called the History Factory. And the History Factory basically runs corporate archives. And it's about conservation and preservation of like corporate archives, but it's also about managing like brand narratives and like heritage brands. So he went to Brooks Brothers, like, you're not doing well, like, let me run your archive, pay me a nominal fee, and I'll run the Brooks Brothers archive. And at the time, I think it was like the late 70s, early 80s, people weren't buying suits. If they were buying suits, they weren't buying Brooks Brothers suits. So they were like, take the archive, we don't care. They weren't sure they'd be around in another 10 years. So they didn't even care. So Bruce and the History Factory took over Brooks Brothers' corporate archive, took it to DC, and sort of became the gatekeepers of the archive. So when I try to get access to Brooks Brothers' archive, I'm actually contacting the History Factory, but the History Factory is sort of like controlling the brand's narrative to a certain extent. So
that's so interesting, because I think probably any U.S. company that goes back to the early 19th century, I'd be very surprised if they didn't have some connection to slavery. But this is kind of a little bit more of an aside. An institution that has a huge connection to slavery is Harvard. And last year you did this amazing exhibition. Can you tell us a little bit more about that exhibition?
Sure. Yeah, I did an exhibition called Slavery in the Hands of Harvard. And I took, I teach at Harvard. And so I took pieces from Harvard's permanent collection that was related to slavery, and I paired it with contemporary artists who were sort of grappling with the legacy of slavery in some way. So it was both historical pieces or reproductions of historical pieces in contemporary art. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, too, because Harvard is a very important American institution, and Brooks Brothers, you can say, to a certain extent, is an American institution.
Absolutely. Can you tell us, have you come across other kind of fashion companies or other companies that have a similar history to Brooks Brothers in this way?
That's a good question. I think Brooks Brothers, in a lot of ways, is singular, because it was created in 1818. It's the oldest surviving American brand. And as far as I know, Levi's, which was formed earlier, doesn't have the same connection to slavery, as far as I know. And of course, there are a few department stores which currently aren't doing well that date from like the mid-19th century, like Lord & Taylor and Macy's. But again, they don't have the same connection to planters in the South. So I think in a lot of ways, Brooks Brothers is singular in this way.
one of the things I really like about your talk is New York was such an embedded part of the slavery system, and people don't really kind of think about that way because, you know, it was in the North, and, you know, we think of New York as such a liberal city. But, you know, slave ships stopped in New York. Like, cotton always stopped in New York before it went to England. So I really like how you're kind of tying this all together. So I take another aside of a little bit. You told me earlier about a United Airlines worker who had some connection to a Brooks Brothers suit. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Oh, yeah. This is an interesting story. So I was contacted by a United Airlines employer, and he told me that someone had forwarded an article. I wrote an article on this in a niche fashion journal called Vestoy, and someone forwarded the article to him. And so he initially told me that, so Brooks Brothers redesigned the United Airlines uniform. And when he saw the uniform, the first thing that popped in his mind is like, I don't want to wear this. This looks like a domestics uniform. And then someone forwarded my article to him, and he was like, oh, there's a history here. There's a connection. It wasn't just an inkling or a feeling that I had. And so he was like, you know, I don't feel comfortable wearing this, knowing Brooks Brothers' history. So he actually reached out to the person who's the head of brand partnerships at United Airlines, and that person reached out to someone at Brooks Brothers, and they actually had a conversation, a meeting, and he told me about it, and he said that, you know, could you send me all the evidence that you found to show, because they weren't copying up to it. They were denying any connection to slavery. Show me the evidence that you have, so when I go back to them, I have proof. And I actually haven't heard from him since then, so I don't know what actually happened. I don't know if he was, you know, given a nice check. Hush, hush money, as it were.
So I have one more question, and then we'll throw it open to the audience. But one of the things that I think is very striking about your work is your use of the word fashion. And, you know, as opposed to uniform, as opposed to clothing, these were styles that were given to enslaved people and kind of, you know, making their bodies a part of, more a part of the system than they even they were. So why use the word fashion? What's your motivation there?
That's another great question. Yeah, people often, like, it's a common reaction when people hear about my research, like, is there a connection between fashion and slavery? And I tried to answer that a little bit in the beginning of the presentation when, you know, fashion is so much associated with the freedom to style yourself and autonomy and self-determination, and slavery is the exact opposite of that. But I think sort of not forcing the connection, but sort of revealing the connection is actually key to telling the story of, you know, one, the story of capitalism, but in one slither of the story of capitalism is the fashion system. And I think if you're denying slavery and coerced labor, or denying the importance of slavery and coerced labor to the rise of the fashion system, then you're missing a key part of the story. So yeah, you know, putting fashion in conversation with slavery is a provocation. Like, I don't want to use the word costume, which to me is sort of special clothing.
It's not really well understood, kind of outside the field. Like, costume means something else to most people.
Right. And dress to me is a little too utilitarian. Mm-hmm. I want to put the institution of slavery in conversation with the fashion system, which I think is very uncommon.
I think fashion, like, you know, is the definition of the word fashion is expanding. And, like, one of the things that always struck me when I would read kind of accounts, especially from slaveholders, and they would talk about their enslaved peoples and how they were obsessed with dress and how, you know, women would take, like, you know, in the 1850s would take reeds and other things and make these crinolines, you know, for their own, you know, for their dresses and try and keep up with these fashionable silhouettes. And you realize how vital it is for people to be able to express themselves through dress, to feel good about the way they look, to you know, kind of buck the system of uniformity. You see it with high school kids in uniforms. Everyone, you know, they want to fight against this idea of uniformity. Mm-hmm. And I think that when we look at it that way, it's very easy to understand, you know, that this, the clothing that they wore, that they manipulated themselves, that they personalized, really was fashion and not just clothing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And also, I feel like enslaved peoples in many ways had very little power, but what they had control over was their own self-presentation. Mm-hmm. So it's one key way of looking at the experience of enslaved peoples by looking at fashion and the way they style themselves.
Yeah. So does anyone have any questions? So I'll just say this off the bat so it's not weird. I'm just going to repeat everybody's questions before we get started so everyone can hear. Why don't you do the choosing?
Okay. What about you? Sorry.
So was there any boycott of Brooks Brothers or other companies, firms that had a large connection to slavery, either by suffragists or by other groups?
Great. Thank you for that question. As far as I know, most people today and in the past weren't aware of Brooks Brothers' connection to slavery. So as far as I know, there hasn't been any boycott specifically of Brooks Brothers. I can tell you that Brooks Brothers in the late 19th century had a livery department that made clothing specifically for domestics, but they didn't particularly specify enslaved domestics, just domestics in general. So there is that history, but as far as I know, no one's ever boycotted Brooks Brothers.
But the products that made the clothing made by slaves, some suffragists or other people who were like-minded were refusing
vis-a-vis Brooks Brothers, I think not. As far as I know, that hasn't been the case. But yeah, I mean,
thank you.
You're welcome.
I have a question.
Oh, sorry. Since you're standing, you can ask your question.
So she's asking what percentage at this time period, I'm guessing the early 19th century, was produced by manufacturers and how much was kind of produced by people at home, by tailors, individual establishments?
Great. I actually don't have a figure for you. I can tell you that Brooks Brothers often say one of their brand narratives is that Brooks Brothers was one of the first manufacturer of ready-to-wear. I suspect that was due to the fact that they were making clothing in part for domestics, and many of those domestics were enslaved peoples. But in terms of like the larger fashion industry, you're right. Most clothes were like made at home, were hand sewn, and it wasn't until the Industrial Revolution and the fashion system gets off the ground until like the mid 19th century, up into the late 19th century, up into the 20th century, that we start getting more ready-made garments. So it's hard to say, but I can tell you that over the course of the 19th century, more and more garments were made in factories as opposed to made at home or hand-sewn.
And if you think about the kind of the styles that people wore historically, fit was so, so important. And so it wasn't until the Civil War where we start to see ready-made menswear, and that was because people needed uniforms. Women's wear wasn't ready-made at all because it had to be fit so precisely. So this idea that they're making clothing for domestics, for enslaved people, where maybe people weren't as concerned about a perfect fit, it makes sense that ready-to-wear would start there. But ready-to-wear in the United States, which was a leader in the world, it was really in the mid-19th century, going into the Civil War, that ready-to-wear became something that was viable.
And if you think about the two Brooks Brothers coats, I can't imagine two enslaved boys walking into a Brooks Brothers retailer and getting fitted for the coats.
I mean, any child at 8 or 9, like.
So I have a couple of questions.
So what are the coats made out of?
They're cotton.
They are. And they look really well preserved.
The lining is silk.
So the question is, who made the clothes for Brooks Brothers, and if there was a relationship between those workers or perhaps sweatshop workers and slaves in the South?
That's certainly a question I'll have to address as I continue this research. Up until this point, I focused on, one, the coats themselves and like the wearers of the coats, and I focused on William Newton Mercer, the man who bought the coats, but I think that's an important part of the story, the manufacturing of the coats. You're absolutely right, they were made in the Northeast or in New York City. And I can't really speak to the labor conditions and, if it was akin to a sweatshop, but I can speak more to, like, the experience of the enslaved boys and the owner of the coats.
Yeah. I have one last question, sorry. And that is, did African slaves bring any of their own skills regarding fabric, indigo, tie-dye, batik, any of that kind of stuff? Because when you're talking about fashion as opposed to clothing, were any of those skills used, or did they bring any of those skills with them, and were they able to use them at all when they were on plantations with that kind of cloth that they were given?
So did African peoples bring their own knowledge of clothing production, of dyeing, of embellishment? Were they able to kind of transfer those skills from their homes in Africa to apply to clothing they made in the United States?
I mean, that question goes at the heart of my research. In the heart of studying enslaved peoples and people of African descent in the Western Hemisphere, to what degree did they maintain cultural connections to the African continent, to what degree did they adapt things from Europe and from, you know, the U.S. or the Caribbean or Latin America. In small ways, you find things like, for instance, I think looking at the tradition of head wrapping is very much something that's Afro-diasporic. But beyond that, I mean, I look at the ways in which enslaved peoples sort of adapted more Western styles of clothing. In small ways, like jewelry and head wraps, things that they were able to maintain, but in general, enslaved peoples sort of adapted what I would call like Euro-American fashion styles.
And I think it's interesting that you think about small ways. I've written a little bit about hair care and hair care practices in Africa and then moving to the United States, and things like combs and other things, if they were able to recreate them in the United States or kind of substitute them out for tools that they had. They did try and create these, bring these social practices. Hair care was a huge social practice in West Africa, and they did try to recreate some of those things as much as they were able. But I also want to add, when you're thinking about the relationship between sweatshop workers and slaves, I mean, capitalism kind of touches everyone. And a really interesting kind of connection that I came across pretty recently was the idea that of enslaved workers who made sugar, and how sugar changed the diet of sweatshop workers in the UK who were spinning the cotton from the South into fabric, and how these people were able to kind of, the sugar in their tea was something that kept them going when they couldn't afford more food. And so this idea that there's this triangle always between enslaved producers, the more industrial producers, and then the people who make the money off of them.
And also to go back to your question, I think if you're not focused solely on the United States, but you consider the Caribbean and Latin America, you do see more Afro-descended elements within fashion amongst enslaved peoples.
the couple of the coats that you showed us, I would assume would be worn by the house servants. And what about the slaves in the field? Did Brooks Brothers make their clothes, or did they make their own out of sacks or napkins?
So did Brooks Brothers make Did Brooks Brothers make clothes for field slaves as well as domestic slaves?
To answer simply, no. Brooks Brothers would manufacture clothing for domestics, so it was only for domestics, some of which were enslaved. But in terms of field slaves, they were often given bolts of fabric. They had to produce their own clothing just through hand sewing. Sometimes they were given cast-offs, old clothing, and sometimes they were given sort of loose, ill-fitting manufactured clothing. So it's sort of a hodgepodge from different places, but they were mostly responsible for making their own clothes.
And just a comment, going back to Levi Strauss, I think they made their fame making uniforms for both sides in the Civil War. That's unrelated to your
research. Right. Thank you.
So in your research, did you come across any advertising from Brooks Brothers for the clothing they specifically made for enslaved wearers? And what was the language or the illustration, the imagery they used to appeal to plantation owners to buy these products?
Another great question. I haven't come across any advertisements, but I've come across catalogs. So Brooks Brothers published livery catalogs. I haven't seen one in person. And I haven't found a library that holds them, but I have seen private collectors that have them. So I really need to get my hands on one of those catalogs, but haven't seen any advertisements specifically for liveries or for enslaved peoples.
When did Sears Roebuck first make a catalog? Do you know when they got started?
Turn of the century?
Yeah, this is the 19th century.
They were pre-Civil War, but the reason I want to see the catalogs is because...
You should see them. I'm just saying that we need to understand that those clothes, those two pieces of clothing, would not never have been in a catalog because of the age, the time at which they were manufactured.
Absolutely. Yeah, the reason I want to see the catalogs is because Brooks Brothers really doesn't talk about the livery department that he had, and that would be proof that they actually produced clothing for domestics. But yeah, you're absolutely right. They were, the coats were made before the Civil War and before catalogs were a thing. Taisha?
Thank you for your talk. I'm sorry to meet you. So you mentioned catalogs as one of your sources, and I was just interested, especially in studying fashion in the early period that you studied. What are some of the other sources that you use in your methodology during your research?
Absolutely.
So besides the catalogs and the physical clothing, what are some other sources that you use and what methodologies you apply to your research?
So I use Beyond, which I haven't actually seen the catalogs yet, but I want to use it as a source. newspapers have been really important. So that article that I showed, the Tailors Appeal, was in the New York Tribune. So newspapers are really important. And you said not actual garments, but the garments actually, I mean, that's the label in the coat is kind of the smoking gun. So I like to read garments as if they are text. And there's actually, you know, textiles and texts have the same Latin root, so clothing can be read as like a document as well.
Were they impressed in the making, or was it just supplying the raw material?
So the first question, have you come across any mention or evidence that enslaved people in the South were used to manufacture clothing for Northern firms or other firms? Were they kind of used in this industrial clothing production?
I haven't really disentangled the full supply chain. I really focused on the finished garment and the experience of like wearing this finished garment, but I think that's actually important. So as I continue this research, I am interested in thinking about, you know, thinking about where the cotton was produced, you know, where it was manufactured somewhere in the Northeast, and what was the experience of actually wearing it. So all angles of the supply chain. But to answer your larger question about, in general, cotton was produced in the South, shipped to Europe or to the Northeast, manufactured into textiles, and then made into clothing, and then shipped back to the South, which is kind of, you would think that you would save money just by producing everything there in the South. Occasionally, you see things about there being like a weaving house on a plantation. So small places here and there, people produce small items in the South, but in general, like sort of mass-produced textiles and garments were produced in the Northeast and in Europe, and then they were shipped back to the South.
And one of the reasons for that is that, you know, cotton growing plantation was so dependent on financing, and that financing came from the North or it came from Europe, and it was with those financiers' best interest to keep the raw products coming from the South and having those manufacturers in the North or in Europe. So they were really the ones kind of controlling. Growing cotton, growing crops is very mercurial. It's, you know, you can get rich or you have a bad season and lose everything. So those financiers who own those factories, they really kind of controlled where things were manufactured. And when Jonathan was saying that people might have woven cloth or made things on the plantation, that was really for the plantation economy and not so much. There was very, very little industry in the South, especially before the Civil War. And the second question was, have you ever thought of the connection between enslaved people and companies like Brooks Brothers and the parallels in the Second World War, the Nazis and their enslaved workers?
Yeah, often when I tell people about my research, that's the connection that they make to like the World War II and to the Holocaust. They often bring up Coco Chanel or Hugo Boss. It's two other clothing brands that still exist that sort of have this sort of sordid, dirty history that no one really talks about. My research is, of course, from an earlier period, but I think I'd be remiss not to admit that there's some connection between sort of that dynamic that no one really talks about, Coco Chanel being a sympathizer, or the fact that Hugo Boss was involved in manufacturing clothing for Nazis, and this history of Brooks Brothers making clothing for enslaved people. So I do think that's an important connection.
I think if we could get the Obamas on the phone, we'd have a lot of things we might ask them to do.
I mean, that's a great idea. I mean, you know, once this talk is over, I'll call them right up. And I wish I had a direct connection to the Obamas. Oh, sorry, I'm not even looking.
So the question was, did Brooks Brothers produce clothing for women, especially kind of the fashionable kind of gowns that we think about Southern plantations at this time?
So Brooks Brothers focused, and it up until the present day, is focused on menswear and suiting. Maybe around maybe the 80s, they start producing women's wear, and the current creative director for women's wear at Brooks Brothers is Zach Posen. But traditionally, Brooks Brothers has been a company that focused on menswear, and they didn't start producing clothing for women, I think, until the late 20th century.
And producing women's wear in the 19th century was very, very complex. And so there were kind of enslaved dressmakers that plantation women would turn to. Everyone at this point was following French fashion, so they wanted to kind of follow that as quickly as possible. There were traveling dressmakers and tailors who would go to plantations in different towns, stay with you a little bit, and make your own clothes. Sometimes women made their own clothes. Even middle class, relatively well-off women would make their own clothes. Everyone could sew. But women's clothing was kind of different from men's clothing at this time, and definitely not as quick to be produced by ready to wear.
Thank you first for this wonderful reading of material culture and social history and personal history. It's wonderful. I can't wait to read the book.
Thank you.
I'm sure you can't wait to write it.
No.
You said at one point that Brooks Brothers was unique in your research as, I think what you meant was, as a purveyor of clothing, of fashion, with this connection to the South and clothing and slavery. But we know from
So in the course of research, did you come across companies that at one time sold to the South or and stopped because of moral reasons or declared kind of that they would not sell, support the slave system by selling their products in the South?
I mean, in short, no. But that would be a question I would like to open up to the audience, because maybe someone here knows of a company that for a moral decision decided, you know, making products for the American South, but... The only example that I can think of is Josiah Wedgwood. Wedgwood was an abolitionist, and he often he was very open about the fact he was an abolitionist. I don't know if he stopped selling dishware to Southern planters. I don't think he did that, but he was an open abolitionist.
And this Wedgwood family.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I want to point out, with this whole thing about this guy was raising money for Donald Trump, and he owned SoulCycle and Equinox. Mm-hmm. Even today, it can be so opaque where, these corporations, who owns them and the connections between them. And, can only imagine that, in the 19th century, even though there were fewer corporations, I think it's probably hard, especially on a day-to-day basis, to kind of think about, all of the moral kind of avenues that these corporations participate in.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Maybe one or two more questions?
Just a bit of information. It's easy to show how much the North supported slavery in the South. In January 1861, the mayor of New York, Fernando Wood, proposed that New York City secede from the state and the Union and join the South. Business that was going on with the South and how much they were interdependent. That's not a secret, it's all over the place. His speeches are quite out there. And it showed the extent of how we are really cut off from how far slavery had permeated our whole society. And it wasn't the South, it was the country that promoted slavery.
Absolutely. The entire economy was kind of tied together. There could not have been any cotton growing without the financiers, the shipping, the suppliers in New York. I mean, the entire reason for expanding west had to do with growing more cotton, the decimation of Native Americans' populations. All of these things are tied into the corporatization of America in the 19th century.
Rogers Peet.
Okay. Could you talk a little bit more about Rogers Peet? I never.
I mean, they're a men's suiting company.
Oh, okay.
That was very active, certainly in the 20th century, late 20th century. I think they still exist.
Oh. Great. Thank you for that.
Do you want to do our last question?
That project is amazing. Like they did some great work. If I had to add one more book to my syllabus that I was that passed around, it would be Sven Beckert, The Cotton Empire.
Mm-hmm. I think. Just wonder where you're going next. That's wonderful information.
Oh, well, hopefully a book at some point, maybe in 5 or 6 years, I'll have a book.
I just went to Emma Cornelian also.
Oh.
And I just went to a wonderful evening with the Cornell University Press, talked about that whole evaporation. Hmm. So maybe talk to them about working on a book for them.
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah, absolutely.
They really nurture their writers.
Thank you, everyone, for all of your questions.
Yeah.
And thank you, Jonathan, for
thank
your
you so
wonderful
much.
Talk.
Thank you.